direction. I can't get no call to action, but I try, and I try, and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp, and I'm Giles Edwards. Today I've caught Spencer and Graham, the co-founders of Gus. Living, walking, cool stuff, doing proof that micro creative agencies do mega things, Gus is the small and superbly formed award-winning agency consisting of Spencer and Graham and the leanest of lean creative crews. But while they may be the same size as most field lacrosse teams, that hasn't stopped them from scooping some enormous accolades, such as the Ad Age Small Agency of the Year Award. Between them, Spencer and Graham have gathered up the kind of creative gongs and glory you'd usually find in a 30-story mega agency, including top honours at Cannes, Forbes, Vimeo, Business Insider, and even a short film in the New York Film Festival. They say, in an era where anyone can spin up a brand and sell in a matter of minutes, having a clear point of view on what you are, who you're for, and why you're different has never been more important. Welcome to the show, Spencer and Graham.
Yo, pleasure to be here, man. Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you so much.
No worries, man. So, quick fires. We're gonna alternate, starting with Spencer. Pizza slice or hot dog?
Oh, pizza slice. Easy.
Small or big?
Big, always big.
Strategy or creativity?
Both. This will be, we're skirting this, and I think we will continue to skirt this.
We will.
Yeah.
Must fit in or misfits?
Graham, you want to take these?
Misfits, every time.
The Sopranos or The Wire?
Ooh, The Wire. I know that's probably a polarizing answer, but gotta love The Wire.
Okay, we've got two more. Gut or Gus?
Gus. But with all due respect.
All right, last one. Pong or Minecraft?
Ooh, well, I'm an old man, I guess, so I'll have to say Pong.
And I'll say Minecraft.
Thank you.
Oh, nice.
My much younger partner, Spencer LaValle.
What's the age gap, just out of interest?
Not much.
Is it a year?
Yeah, a year.
Nice. Amazing. Cool. Good stuff. Well, welcome to the show, firstly. I think the point that we chatted briefly on ahead of recording was that often wiggly, sometimes straight route that people take to get into our industry. So, Graham, let's start with you. How did you first start up? What was your first ever job? And then what was your first creative job?
My first ever job was when I was 15. I was a janitor at a water park in Texas, where I grew up. So basically cleaning up trash under the hot Texas sun all summer. A very humbling first job.
Nice. And at that stage, did you have any inkling or desire to join the ads agency world?
I had no idea what an ad agency was, I don't think.
Right.
You know, I think a lot of our sort of contemporaries are the children of, or the kind of, I don't know, cousin of someone that's done this before. And I had absolutely no sense of what advertising as an industry or business or company was at all.
Yeah. I mean, it's something we routinely hear. There's this idea that people stroll in casually into the industry, but I think most kind of trip over, bang their head and find themselves in it. Did you go to college? Did you have any kind of ambition to do any particular career? How did you actually end up here?
I did go to college, but I originally thought I wanted to study jazz. I was a saxophone player and a musician for most of my young life. But then I got to like a really competitive jazz program and looked up and saw people who were actually good musicians and kind of said, uh-oh, I'm fucked. But at the same time, I was taking like big lecture hall intro to the advertising class just to satisfy a communications credit and liked it. and was looking for an out, I think, at the same time that I was liking this class. And I decided, cool, I'll just pursue this for a little while. So I did end up getting like a comm design and advertising degree out of college, but not without a little zigging and zagging to get there.
Nice. And what was the first gig you had in Adland?
Well, I worked at a publicist's office in Dallas, Texas that I technically just started showing up there. Like, I didn't have a job. I just had a friend that had a key card who was an intern. So I just started kind of showing up and working on stuff. And before long, I had, you know, a desk and a computer and a phone and I think business cards even. And so I did that for like 6 months before I actually got a job there. I just kind of appeared and started working on things for a while.
Seriously? So was there no like security issue? You just managed to get in on someone's key card and just...
Yeah. You know, this is like the beautiful thing about those like big, big agencies is the HR department is so far away from the creative department that no one notices. And of course, if there's like a body to throw at a project, then of course your creative director is going to say, great, here you go. Here's 10 briefs that need cracking. Go, go do this so I don't have to.
Oh, wow. And so in what capacity were you doing that? Was it copywriting, art directing?
Yeah, a little bit of both. I went to school technically for more design than writing, and then the job was a copywriting job. So I just started doing that. And I'm sure, as you know, and this industry loves to put people in their lanes and into their rate cards for billing purposes. So I just remained a copywriter for a long time after that.
And at what point did you get your own key card? Like, at what point did someone say, oh, you don't actually work here, maybe we should employ you?
Yeah, it's a great question. My intern partner, who actually did have a proper job there, he and I were put on a pitch that I think we won the pitch, or like our idea made it to the pitch. And after that, we just went to the HR office and brought, you know, a creative director with us and said, we would like jobs here, please. I think this guy will tell you why you should give us a job here. And they did.
Wow, that's amazing. Wow. Spencer, what about your career then? How did that kick off? And is it as suspicious and such a tale of espionage as Graham's?
In a way, kind of. I mean, if we're talking about our very first job, I was a summer camp counselor for a number of years. It was like my introduction into the working world and, you know, a very powerful lesson in the persuasive arts, trying to get, you know, massive groups of screaming kids to listen to you and to play together and have fun. So there's a lot of creative applications of how you can get these kids to follow the rules and obey. But I sort of had an interesting path into the world of advertising, where I mentioned this, you know, even before we started our podcast, but I studied abroad for a year in London at UCL. And it just so happened that there was, through my program, an open internship at Yahoo Europe. And I had never considered working in the field of sort of communications or advertising, but the internship seemed interesting and I, you know, wanted to get some experience. And I remember going and just like showing up for this internship, being so green. And I'll never forget like the boisterousness of youth is where I had like a Gmail account, obviously. And they were like, yeah, let's get you on the Yahoo email. And I was sort of like, nah, I'm pretty good with with Gmail. Like, this is really great. Like, it's doing the job. And there was something about the pushback and the not like just blindly following the rules that they seemed to get a real kick out of. So I don't know. It was kind of funny where I ended up just throwing random briefs at me. And I ended up sort of being put on a sort of just like a banner ad writing brief. Really brass tacks, low level stuff. And it just turned out that whatever I ended up writing for like the 15 words I could fit into the banner template performed the best out of any of the stuff they ran. And it was like in that moment where I was like, wait a second, this could be a career. There could be a career here. So after graduation, I ended up moving to New York. And again, I had no proper advertising degree or training, just, you know, a bit of a dream and the ability to BS a little bit. So I'll never forget, I got my first gig in New York City as an intern by replying to a Craigslist ad where I spoke with an ECD and we just talked about drumming. I was like, I love playing music, and we just connected over the art of drumming and how fun it is and the drummers we like and the music we like. And it was enough to squeeze in the door and get a little bit of get a bit of a start. And literally from there, it was a bit of a fake it till you make it story. I just, you know, kept showing up, kept trying my best, and slowly but surely just tried to find the people and the places that felt like they were doing the work that I cared about, or that felt aligned with the, I don't know, the path I was trying to lead. I'll never forget that it was a few months later where I was out, you know, it was crazy. I entered the working world in 2008, which was where there was this big recession. And in my first few weeks of work, I saw, like, a no joke, 30 to 60 people get laid off over that first summer. Like right away, it was just so clear that, like, oh, this is this working world is no sort of cakewalk, right? You are here, and it is a hustle. You need to sort of really fend for yourself and carve your own path and find your own way. So I remember walking out through the city, and I saw an out of home ad that I loved, and I went, "This is what's up. This is the kind of work I want to be doing." And I just went to my computer, did some research, found out the agency that made the ad, cold emailed them, tried to put on the best possible email, you know, front I could. And they offered up an interview. And I remember being so nervous because I wanted it so bad. And, like, my mom was like, you need to go in looking the part. And I went to Men's Warehouse and bought, like, an oversized tan blazer. And I showed up just feeling so out of place. Like, everyone is just wearing normal people clothes. And here I am in this goofy tan blazer. Like, oh my God, what have I done? But long story short, I somehow managed to secure that gig. And, you know, I guess from there, the people you meet, the impressions you make, all sort of laddered up to the next opportunity and the next opportunity until I really felt like I was hitting my stride.
That's amazing. Do you remember what the outdoor ad was?
Yeah, 100%. So the name of the agency I went to work at was called Campfire. And they're really well known. They're still around today, like, really, really powerful creative company, but they're really, really well known for sort of like their transmedia campaign work. Like, this was kind of at a time where a lot of businesses were, like, working with entertainment properties and really blurring the line between, like, kind of the story world of the TV shows or movies they were advertising, and, like, the marketing itself was just, like, an extension of those story worlds. So I remember this was at a time a show for HBO was coming out called True Blood. And the premise of the show True Blood was a synthetic blood beverage is invented, which allows vampires, which had up to this point needed to remain in the shadows because, you know, they couldn't expose themselves. But now that they could drink the synthetic blood, suddenly they can exist in the world, right? And it was just so incredible where the whole campaign that Campfire did to promote the show was just to launch the drink True Blood, like it was an actual product. So you sort of, it was a prequel in a way to the events of the show. And I just saw it. It felt so meta in the right way, so intriguing. The rollout was awesome. And I was like, all right, this kind of world building, this kind of attention to detail in, like, a 360 way is the stuff I love. And so I sought it out.
It's funny how one of the observations I've had from, I suppose, working in the industry as long as I have, is that the kind of gateway drug into the industry for so many creatives is an outdoor media piece. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it sort of sneaks up on you, right? You know, yeah. I think I had always known, I mean, again, I didn't go to school for advertising, but I'd always known I loved storytelling. I loved communication. I loved system creation, right? Especially, you know, when you feel like a story world is using all the different mediums at their strongest to, like, build a larger world. And the deeper you dug into the world of advertising communication, like, that's exactly what the best campaigns do. Take a look at all the media they have at their disposal, and how do you use each one to tell the strongest possible individual story that ladders up to a singular larger story. And that's basically following that thread still to this day with the work we do at Gus has been sort of my journey.
Yeah, no, it sounds good. It's well articulated. I'm really interested talking to you guys specifically because one of the observations we made as a whole business and agency here was that Gus is very much a kindred spirit of ours. You're a bit of a brother from another mother, or sister from another mister, whatever you want to call it. Like, there's so many parallels between us and you. And it's really interesting because we don't identify as an advertising agency. And I think advertising is obviously a key part of what we do get involved in. But for us, everything starts with that kind of brand and that positioning piece. Graham, your journey, and perhaps if you can touch on how you and Spencer first, I suppose, met and then latterly decided to set up a business together. How much of your journey did kind of straddle advertising, but also like marketing and positioning and strategy? Because you've kind of got this lovely merge of the two. And I just wonder how that started. Because in my mind, it simultaneously must have happened in both of your minds independently before creating this partnership.
Yeah, Giles, I think you're right. I mean, Gus has only been around for a few years, but Spencer and I have known each other for, gosh, probably 13 or 14 years. We were both creatives and creative directors at Droga 5. And when that place was, you know, one room with a few dozen people in it, and then it stayed there and worked there for a really long time and watched it grow. And I hope I can say had a hand in kind of the arc, the story arc of that place as well. And I think even way back then, Spencer and I kind of like gravitated towards working together because we just both liked those projects that were essentially brand transformation projects. We just didn't have the word for it, you know, like the briefs that where the output wasn't just, or the goal wasn't just something pretty or something funny or, you know, something poignant, but actually like the big meaty problem that could actually like change the course of a company. But we were creative, so the only toolbox we had to do that was using our creativity. And I still see those bedrocks in what we're doing here at Gus still today.
Yeah, amazing. Anything to add to that, Spencer?
No, completely agree. Other than I think even though Graham and I met at Droga 5 and were sort of, you know, kind of colleagues and contemporaries there, our story continued over many years where each of us sort of went and did our own thing. Graham notably went sort of kind of client side and was working as like head of brand at Vimeo for a number of years. And then at some point we reconnected where Graham needed to sort of kind of reposition Vimeo. They were going through sort of a big pivot to their product and their overview, and they needed to reposition and launch a big sort of creative campaign to announce this new position to the market. And I was working kind of as a lead creative at an advertising agency. And we just sort of essentially partnered up across the aisle where Graham was like, do you want to lead this Vimeo work with, you know, with me on the other side sort of helping shepherd? And we were like, yeah, let's do it. So the sort of true origin story of Gus was where literally I was the agency and Graham was the client, but really we were just like working in tandem to make the best stuff possible. And I think, you know, having worked in capacities where it always felt like there was, you know, a little bit of animosity between client and agency, and you go into a meeting like you're wearing a suit of armor. I need to force an idea down your throat, you know, and where really it was like, if we can both align on what right looks like about what the goals we're trying to achieve and both work as closely as we can to like solving the big problem, that's good for everyone, you know. And I think after the success of that project, we both looked at each other and were sort of like, let's see if we keep doing this. What happens if we sort of kept doing it? So kind of interesting, the phases of the build-up, if you will.
Yeah. Graham, given Gus was founded on that principle of strategy and creativity should, you know, no longer be siloed, do you find that tends to happen more client side than it does agency side, or are both sides guilty?
I think all parties are guilty. We call departments different things sometimes or give people different titles, but oftentimes the people who are tasked with solving the you know, the big multi-year problems are people with MBAs, people that wear suits, you know, people that sit in a different team than the folks who are actually communicating to an audience what this company does and why you should believe in the mission. And I think we've seen that on the agency side quite often too. So I don't know. It's Spencer touched on this when he was talking about our experience as client and agency. But I think I kind of like, when I started at Vimeo, I had enough of that perspective to know that, oh, this company needs like a really clear redefinition, a really clear pivot. But I also know we don't have 6 to 8 months to do a traditional strategy motion where the output is charts and arrows and pyramids that aren't actionable. You know, like we needed to redefine this company and make it actionable in 2 months in a way that was the proto business model of Gus taking shape in real time. It's like essentially what we did with Vimeo is what we do with most of our partners at Gus these days.
Yeah, your comment there, and when we were doing the research, a similar comment about how strategy is often kind of manifests itself with all sorts of rhomboids and so on and so forth. There's a lovely quote from Mark Ritson. It must be about 10 years ago now, because I had to dig out a really old deck to pull this one out of my memory bank. And it's in response to, you know, the theory of mental and physical availability from Ehrenberg Bass Institute. And it really reminded me of a lot that comes from your mouths, which is the idea that brands must be available in the mind and on the shelf to sell might sound obvious, but trust me, most modern marketing departments are too busy workshopping the values inside their new rhomboid of brand trust, or working out how to get a 3D ad on the new Wankometer 8000 VR machine to have such prosaic concerns anymore. And I wonder, yeah. I salute you for the way you've positioned Gus and your approach to strategy and creativity. And I wonder how much of that is different versus the fact it's just good work and good thinking. Because I think just the law of averages, there's so much bad marketing, bad advertising, bad kind of comms planning, bad media investments out there that actually whichever way works for you works.
I don't think you can have one without the other. You know, I think in a way that's the value of smashing creative and strategy together is, I mean, you're in this business too. How often have you seen a bulletproof strategy in a strategy document that's articulated in a 40-word positioning statement and you're convinced that it's the answer until the creative team starts running at it and you realize, uh-oh, it's full of holes, you know? This actually isn't a proposition that's going to resonate with people.
It's not singular enough, right? There's you took so many words to say it that when it comes time to actually communicating it sharply, efficiently to an audience, there's too much to hold on to. It wasn't refined enough.
Yeah. So when you talk about that big thing and making it part of every little thing that your clients do, how does that what does the process of that look like? Like, how does that come to fruition?
Yeah, well, I think Spencer just mentioned it. I think the singularity that Spencer was just talking about is critical, and not just for us as creatives and strategists, but for businesses. Like, I can't tell you how many times we've sat down with a partner of ours with their brand new, hot off the presses brand pyramid, and they look at it and go, cool, which floor of this house or pyramid am I looking at? You know, like, so our first sort of part of the process is great. Like, let's take all the inputs. I want all the research. I want to talk to everyone on the team. You know, we really want to get our heads around the opportunity and the headwinds. And then we go about seeing how we can say that in a creative statement, you know, a single-minded kind of creative North Star for the brand, that we call it a brand platform. But it's essentially that exercise of taking all of the pieces that classically you would call strategy and turn them into the single-minded point of view that classically we would call creative. But we feel like it's not finished until you can sort of say it in a sentence and put it in a headline.
Yeah, one of our barometers for success as we're doing this motion is we call it the mural test. Does our articulation pass the mural test? Where if you couldn't walk into the office of our partner, paint that brand platform on the wall in huge letters, and feel like everybody that walks into the office that day to go to work can look at that articulation and go, I know what I'm doing here today. You know, if they're tasked with a tough choice between A and B, if they were to remember that turn of phrase, would it be easier for them to choose A or B, you know, make the right call, follow the right North Star? That's something we constantly think about and kick around, because for us, when we're doing the planting these big ideas, they're important for like the trajectory of the internal workings of a company and the employees, as they are for what a consumer thinks about the brand and the product.
One of the things that we find can add friction, if you like, to that process is how much of that brand platform or North Star or, you know, positioning statement, I think, you know, terms will vary and there's no issue, there's no problem with that, is how much of that is internal facing and how much is external facing? It sounds like you prioritize external facing, which is often the right approach. And one of the sticking points that we find is that businesses can not get caught up in their internal positioning, but often see them as the same thing. Do you come across that problem at all?
Funny enough, we think about it exactly the opposite way. To us, the most critical first initial audience is an internal audience. Because at the end of the day, the people that are building the product and answering the customer service inbound and designing the, you know, email drips, if they're not bought in and they don't really understand what this really unique creative point of view is, it almost doesn't matter what the advertising says. Because the advertising might get someone in the door, but if the brand and the product doesn't continually deliver on that same thing, then we haven't done our job. We just think that the best way of expressing that is in a way that we've traditionally looked at things externally, you know, as a more creative articulation that has a tone and has a point of view and has a sort of economy of language. That's usually a tagline or a headline, not an onboarding document that's 50 pages long, you know, that every employee has to go through and in the end doesn't understand.
Yeah, it's everything comes back to simplicity.
In a world of AI, sort of suddenly every day making it easier and easier to just create and generate and optimize content, you know what I mean? It feels like it's never been more important to have a big human, you know, idea at the heart of what you're doing and why you're doing it. Because at some point, if it's just a race to the sort of micro increases that performance can bring versus sort of actually having an idea that can connect to the hearts and minds of your customers and know why they want to reach for you or engage with you, it feels like they're just a shift in thinking about that ROI and where sort of it can be found and invested in feels like something we think a lot about and have a perspective on.
Time, weather, and
we interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on proper marketing. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
Marketing is incredibly confused with sales.
I think you're the one who's more confused, Gary V. Sunshine. Here we go.
You just mentioned AI, and one thing that really stood out for me in our research and notes for today is just how refreshing your take on AI is. You've written that obviously AI is going to be seismic. Now, that alone, as a kind of admission, is actually surprisingly rare to hear. You then go on to state that you're actually very optimistic about AI and creativity. I think too many people probably see AI as being something that's versus creativity as opposed to something that can maybe, you know, integrate and be part of.
Sure. I mean, for starters, I think we beat this to death already, but clearly we believe in having like a really clear, big idea that your business is built around. And that is inherently a really novel, creative thought, right? And I think when we look at AI and even get under the hood of large language models and how they're built, they are in effect designed to find averages, you know, to take on an internet's worth of data and find the average of that information based off of your prompt. And it feels like magic because we've never seen a computer talk like an average person before. But with technology that's built to create average, then remarkability and novel thought becomes an immediate differentiator. There are going to be plenty of brands that lean completely on AI to do their strategy, their marketing, their creatives, and they will, I think, inherently end up in a place that is fine, but average, which opens up a huge white space for those folks who want to invest in being different and novel and more creative. And as a creative person, that gives me a lot of optimism.
Yeah, I suppose if AI and LLMs can only be trained on what's happened, it's inevitably going to end up that average or going to come out beige. There are, I mean, there's an increasing amount of noise, obviously, in AI. I didn't think it could get any louder, but it will inevitably get louder. But there's an increasing amount of trust and faith put into, say, synthetic research tools. We had Peter Weimer on the most recent episode, and his business Evidenza, which creates synthetic research from hard to reach segment samples. There's also other kind of strategy AIs out there that probably offer a lot of what Gus does and what Gasp does. How much of a threat are they?
Yeah, I think obviously, you know, the last thing you want to do is underestimate the seismic shifts that artificial intelligence is going to. But I also think the last thing you want to do is underestimate the importance of the human mind in cracking ideas that resonate and connect, you know, and I think we think a lot about, you know, we use a lot of generative AI tools at Gus. And I think one place we've seen them be incredible is, you know, we mentioned before, small on purpose, right? How can we sort of punch above our weight with a small but mighty team designed to do the best work we can? And for us, generative AI tools have supercharged our ability to create work quickly and efficiently with a small team, you know, firing on all cylinders, right? And I think it comes down to this idea of ultimately the crafting of the prompt generation. Like, what is the curation, if you will? You know, like, what is the taste level that you're putting into something? For all of the AIs that are spitting out ideas or, you know, potential outcomes, the ability to have the intuition to curate, to select, to craft the prompt, to green light, to pick and choose and set, feels fundamentally like the important work that is still done, right? Because at the end of the day, all of those tools are still going to need to sort of be yes or no'd or greenlit, you know, the outputs of or edited or pushed. So for us, it feels like the fodder they can create, the work of creating, you know, thought starters is amazing. But at the end of the day, you're still going to need to create the executive decisions about what you curate, what you take, what you kind of go forward with. And there's a level of taste and intuition there that is still extremely important and required.
Yeah, well said. Well said. You just mentioned small on purpose. Is that going to change, do you think, in the light of your Ad Age Small Agency of the Year accolade? Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. No, I don't think so. We never set out to build a big agency. You know, I think we've worked at those places and have learned a ton. But I think in this day and age, being flexible and being able to shape shift is like a real competitive advantage. And like, ultimately, we just want to say yes to the most exciting opportunities. And some of those aren't going to have a price tag that can support that 34 business that you were alluding to in your intro, Giles. So I don't know. I'm excited about the challenge of trying to do more with fewer but better people than just trying to throw as many bodies as possible at a problem and hope that something comes out the other side.
Yeah. You also have a very similar take to us in your quote of, "We only work with excellent people who aren't assholes." That's a narrow target.
It's a very narrow target. And I'll tell you, with scale, the target gets even narrower because eventually some asshole's gonna creep in.
Yeah.
Exactly that. I've got a listener question. This kind of on this same topic, so I'm gonna head there now. So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger. I'm going to start from a brilliant US marketer, Julio Del Buffalo, or I call him Jimmy Bison. Jimmy has said, "This is a very difficult time for bigger agencies, but might be an opportunity for smaller ones." Is that correct?
Yeah, I would say it's correct. It's been an interesting time, I think, for all agencies. Just people working in this field, I think everyone listening can relate that it's been a very interesting year, you know, just in terms of you know, just the a weird kind of shifting economy and you know, obviously AI contributing to all of it. But with the idea of there being an opportunity for smaller, more nimble agencies, I think 100%. You know, in our estimation, we've seen, you know, kind of in many ways like the death of the AOR, or just so much fewer agencies of record and clients are, you know, building stables of thinkers and agencies that they like, and you kind of pulling that stuff in. And I think what we found is that being small and nimble, to Graham's point, allows us to say yes to the projects that are most exciting to us, and not be forced to say yes to projects that aren't going to push things forward for us, or aren't going to be the kind of things that tickle our fancy and get us excited to come to work every day, right? So it feels like when you have that flexibility where you can sort of find a way to compromise on a budget or a project to make it work because you know it's going to be an incredible output, or when you find a way to sort of, you know, especially with like, you know, our network of friends and freelancers, you know, staff up the exact right crew to absolutely crush a brief that needs particular expertise versus just using the stable of hires that you have and making it work. I think there's just a level of kind of curation and customization that can happen where you can not only say yes to the exact projects you want, but then find a way to knock them out of the park with the exact talent required to bring the vision to life. So yeah, I definitely think it's a good time to be small and nimble and roll with the punches in what has been, you know, kind of a turbulent few months.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, both from a kind of financial perspective globally, there's certainly a cost of living crisis in the UK and no doubt beyond, but also the industry as a whole. I think there's been under so many commercial pressures for probably, you know, at least a decade or two anyway. So finding that new shape of what is the most effective shape of a business and consultant or agency is very much a topical thing. It's funny, I remember talking to someone who had exclusively only worked with big network agencies, and I'll avoid mentioning any particular names, but when I was talking to him about our model, which is, you know, not dissimilar to your own, I simply asked how many people he would typically work with at big agency name, and he kind of concluded there's probably only a handful of critical people. And I just said, well, those five people, say, that's us now. Like, just because you work with a big network agency, you don't actually work with everyone at that big network agency. There's probably still only like two really crucial people, maybe five important people. So actually that model should make more sense than it does. But I understand there's a risk aversion that play too.
It's so funny you bring that up, Charles. We talk about that with clients all the time who maybe are more comfortable working with your name brand big agency. But at the end of the day, big agencies are just a bunch of little agencies who have the same email address, you know, like, and so as a business leader, your choice is working with a small agency within a bigger agency that's made up of hopefully some hitters, but very likely some green behind the ears, younger folks who maybe don't have all the experience in the world, or a small agency that's just a small agency where you're working directly with founders, directly with really senior people who have been kind of like assembled and curated, you know, just for the task at hand.
Yeah, exactly that. Well, again, kudos to you guys because you're so open and transparent with that as your position. I had a conversation with another US, brilliant US marketer, Philip Oakley, yesterday, and he rang me up to ask me a few questions about if we had started Gasp again today or tomorrow, what would we do differently? And the first answer I have was just to be brutally honest about who and what you are and who and what you aren't. Because I think there was a pressure, I don't know where it came from, but there was a pressure to kind of act as if you were bigger or hope people would perceive you to be bigger than we actually were. So yeah, it's really nice that you've embraced that. It's just a shame it took a few years to do the same.
believe me, we're still figuring it out also.
Yeah, sure. Nice.
Yeah, it is wild. Sometimes you hear stories in the past of like agencies doing pitches and like literally hiring actors to fill seats in an office to sort of project as bigger and stronger. And I don't know, man, it feels like the days where that is the motor sort of done. You know, I think there's just an artifice at the heart of assuming that bigger is better, that is, it's exciting. You know, in some ways it's just exciting to puncture and be a part of a movement of agencies like ours that are showing what small can do. And what happens when you invest in people that are really motivated and really care about making the best thing possible?
Yeah, totally. I think it comes from the same place as the feeling you needed to buy a tan jacket for that interview.
Yes. Yes. Keeping up with the Joneses, keeping up with appearances, you know, 100%. You know, there's just a a feeling of like, this is the way it's done and the way it's always been done. But I think, you know, like a through length of this whole conversation has just been like, this is an industry in turmoil. Things are changing. There are factors from artificial intelligence to economic uncertainties that are dramatically shaking the ground beneath our feet. And clinging on to vestiges of the old world or the old way it's been done is unhelpful, unnecessary, and quite frankly, not going to allow you to get ahead and navigate the new world. So it is funny, man, like just kind of having to almost force yourself into a feeling of not discomfort, but just like plotting ahead and boldly doing the thing you believe in versus trying to keep up with appearances or the Joneses and being as radically yourself as you can is a strength in this kind of weird new world.
Well said. I'm not sure who best to direct the second listener question to. You'll probably both have your thoughts. So this question has come from Emma. Emma says, what the hell, good start, inspired your crazy ass website? I found myself playing ping pong with Julia Roberts for a good 15 minutes the other day.
Thank you, Emma.
I mean, and really, I'm just going to say exactly the same thing that Spencer just said, but to a different question. Like, we have kind of tried to approach Gus since the very beginning as doing the opposite. Our office is a small tattoo parlor that's a storefront in the Lower East Side, not a big Madison Avenue business. We don't have...
Former tattoo parlor. Maybe not former. You know, like I think, yeah, all we need is the tattoo gun. And future tattoo parlor.
Yeah, yeah. But I think we really do try to genuinely approach every single thing we do from, you know, starting this business to how it lives on the internet in a really different way. And, you know, I just think we got exhausted by all of the agency sites that all kind of look and feel the same and feel like they're built off the same template. So when we decided to, invest in a side of our own, we just wanted to do something that felt, I guess, a bit more strategically creative or creatively strategic or however you want to articulate it.
Yeah. To us, we were just trying to almost like get down to the heart of Gus and what we believe and what we love. And there's like this, when you think about creative strategy, there is an insight that creates a larger system of thinking, right? Like system-minded thinking that actually allows for unbridled, amazing creativity, right? You know, and for us, like the Gus grid is that canvas, right? This seemingly regimented, structured grid that as you start to dig in deeper, operates in all sorts of unexpected and interesting ways, you know? So there's just like kind of a metaphor at the heart of our grid that has became almost like the user interface for how you navigate our website about this structure, this inherent structure allowing for unbridled creativity just felt like a really cool, just embodied the feeling of what we're trying to create every time we sort of partner up with a client to give them the big idea.
Yeah, it's nice. And I think, you know, whilst I acknowledge that you're, you know, still very much in your infancy, it's nice to see an agency that has a definite style. Graham mentioned doing the opposite. And I think it's exactly that, the breaking norms, the breaking category conventions. And I'm thinking specifically of your work with Backmarket, because that's just come to mind as doing exactly that. So yeah, no, it's really encouraging to see. It's lovely work.
Thanks, man. Yeah.
And it's funny, the website has been a little bit self-selecting in a way that we didn't expect it to. You know, we'll get on, you know, chemistry calls, new business calls with folks, and I'd say about half the time they're like, wow, what a cool website, we love it. And the other half of the time they're like, I don't get it. And it's inevitably those phone calls are the ones that kind of end in, you know, we're probably not the right fit.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, let's launch into a project together.
Yeah. Well, funny enough, that was another point I made to Philip yesterday on this call, which was qualify earlier. Like qualify as soon as you can qualify.
Yes.
And as to your point, that worked both ways. A client needs to qualify you as much as you need to qualify them. Are you familiar with the agency PAM, P-A-M? It's a Swiss agency run by a good friend of mine, Parvez, and they have one of the best kind of websites for positioning to qualify. And it's a long list. It's almost like written as a manifesto, but there's 100 different reasons not to call them in one long list.
Oh, that's so fun.
Do not call us if you don't think the logo could be bigger. Do not call us if it's just, it's wonderful. But yeah, check it out.
I love it.
So listen, guys, the final part of the interview is our four pertinent poses. I feel like I should allow both of you to answer all four, really. So starting with you, Spencer, what advice would you give to your younger self?
I mean, I think it's honestly advice I'd give to my younger self and advice I'd give to my current self. And I think will be advice I will continue to give to myself until the very end here is just live in the moment. You know, I think in the crazy world we work in and the pace at which life moves these days, I think oftentimes you find yourself striving for the next big milestone or the next huge, you know, change in this or that. And even sort of arriving at being an agency founder, you know, you sort of then look back at all of the moments that led up to it and you sort of realize that there's just, life is this incredible journey that if you can't stop and enjoy the moment as you're in it, you're missing out on the bigger point. And even today, you know, as we're being founders and there are a myriad of pressures and responsibilities that are sort of new and we have to navigate every day. Just when I can find the time to actually take a look around and realize that, like, the stuff we've accomplished and the just, like, I don't know, just the joy of what we're doing, the fact that we get to do it is always time well spent, you know, reflecting and living in the moment.
Yeah, well said. Well said. I fully agree. The fact we get to turn up and do irreverent, witty stuff is a joy. And I hope you don't mind me sharing that you're a new parent. So to hear you say live in the moment, I think his son probably never been so apt.
I think being a new parent is just doubles down on it. You know, my daughter is 3.5 months old, and even you look back at pictures when she was 1 month old and she's a different, you know, a different being, you know, just in realizing that, like, if you have to stop and enjoy these moments because they are so fleeting and are so temporal that it's been an incredible reminder of how important it is to soak it and try as best you can.
Great. Great advice. Graham, what about you, buddy?
I think fairly similar. My biggest piece of advice would be don't rush it to my younger self. I think I had a vision for what I wanted to do and was just moving as fast as I could to get there, graduated college early, tried to, you know, as I mentioned, sat in a company for 6 months to get a job. And I don't know, I think it took me a long time to realize the value of making time to be bored and be uncomfortable and not have a plan, because oftentimes that's when the real inspiration strikes, is when you allow yourself to kind of be free from, you know, the burden of, oh, I gotta check this box, or I've gotta, you know, close this ticket or whatever. So don't rush it.
Yeah, there's a lot of sense in that. I like that. I like that a lot. Graham, do you want to take a lead on the second one, which is, if you could banish one thing from the industry, what would it be and why?
A good one. There's so many. This could be a whole other podcast. No, I think that the thing that bugs me the most and that we've tried to do differently at Gus is I think our industry has lost the ability to take bets on people. We're so margin focused and immediate output focused that we hire sure things out of brand name schools and brand name agencies. And I think we've shortchanged ourselves in not looking for the folks who have a different perspective, have raw talent, and are excited to be coached and mentored. Because I've just, in my experience, that's where the best creatives come from. I would try my damnedest to reinstate a sense of mentorship and teaching and coaching in an effort to get more diversity of opinion in the room and just make that a critical part of the infrastructure of what we do again.
Yeah, well said. There's I don't know if you've heard Rory Sutherland tell the story of how he first got his job at Ogilvy, but because he is, by his own words, an eccentric oddball, Ogilvy were actually hiring 4 people at once, and he's adamant that had they not been, there's no way he would have got a job. But it was almost a case of they hired the 3 kind of safe bets, if you like, and then collectively agreed to take a chance on the oddball.
Yeah, I think it would be hypocritical for us at places like Gasp and Gus to, you know, spend half of our time talking to potential clients saying, hey, you should really take a chance on, you know, a partner that's not, you know, a household name that's been around for a century, and then turn around and only go find talent from brand name agencies or the handful of schools that tend to produce good people.
Yeah, Exactly that. And it's funny because we, for years now, lent on the word misfits a lot in our comms and our creds deck. So to see you guys embracing the same word was another reason why we felt so kind of kindred. Spencer, anything you would banish from the industry?
Yeah, definitely. And I think I'll probably get a lot of head nods for this, but like huge month-long grueling unpaid pitches is...
Yes.
I mean, especially to a small agency like ours, increasingly untenable. You know, I think for us, there is such an opportunity cost when we decide to bear down and actually invest in a pitch. And I mean, these big pitches are basically designed only for large agencies that have pitch teams, that have kind of resources to sink into something. And when we're a small, mean team that cares a bunch, it's so hard and takes so much of a kind of operationalizing for us to really dig in and pitch that we just do it infrequently. We have to really kind of dig in and really care. And for us, like finding chemistry, you know, making sure that our credentials match up, really starting to understand our clients, what their problems are, how we would go about approaching that problem to get to a solution. Really just creating a relationship is something that, you know, we love to do. And it just feels like there's so many incredible opportunities that we know we could just crush and excel at, that yeah. The just requirements of a lot of these pitches are just sort of outside of things that we can oftentimes, you know, resource or invest in. So I don't know, it feels like in a world where there's so much talent ripe to be unleashed, there's a weird gatekeeping thing that happens with the structure of a lot of these pitches that I think is stifling potential.
Yeah, I mean, that's a hard agree from this side. Funny enough, we've always, to go back to the earlier point about qualifying as soon as you can, we've always used those as a qualifying process of sorts. If we just explain our reasons why we don't do unpaid pitches, it either starts a really good conversation or ends a really shit one, in my experience. Yeah. And I think the conditions you're afforded in most pitch processes, not always, of course, but they also don't allow for you to do the work that would be required anyway. So the process is just so highly flawed. And I think the more agencies that take that stance, then the better place we'll be in.
100%.
Number three, are there any books that you can recommend to our listeners? They don't have to be work related, but, you know, of course they can be.
Yeah, totally. I've recently gotten back into just reading novels, like good old fashioned novels. I don't know why, just taking a little time to slow your brain down and be whisked away to a different environment. I read a book recently called Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow that I thought was really good, sort of a set in the backdrop of like the video game development world. You know, you follow these central characters over many years as their lives change and intertwine, but just I have really interesting sort of this, you know, novel set in such a modern context, but with, you know, very timeless themes that I don't know, it just felt fresh and interesting and continually reminding you that, oh yeah, you know, books can still be interesting and vital. You know, the modern novel can still be interesting and vital. And I guess books in terms of like, you know, maybe more work related is, I recently did this thing called The Artist's Way. And I don't know if any of you at home have heard it. It's really cool. It's sort of designed. It's almost like a program that this woman designed many, many years ago, where it's essentially to help you get back in touch with, you know, the inner artists at the core of who you are, you know? And I don't know. I found running an agency has been really interesting, whereas even though we're creatives at heart, I found myself wearing so many different hats at being a founder, that I almost wanted to take a little bit of time before my daughter was born to, like, I don't know, reground myself as a creative and as an artist and as someone that you know, focuses on that craft in a really serious way. So long story short, like, what the practice, the book asks you to do at its simplest is just wake up every morning and write. You're not editing, you're not rereading. You're just sort of letting ideas flow out of you, and you have a mandate of pages you need to fill. And just the act of writing without stopping, of thinking without critiquing or editing or turning it into a larger product, I found to be a really refreshing, I don't know, just like path towards letting ideas come out and not stopping things in their tracks or restricting things. So the Artist's Way book/program was kind of a really cool, refreshing way just to get in touch with the creativity that is always sitting right below the surface that you just don't allow yourself to
to unleash?
It's like a multi-week, like month-long sort of program, you know, that just sort of has you just getting into a mode of writing and thinking and not critiquing. And there's a lot of other, you know, kind of bits and bobs and like making time every week to go out and doing something creative just for yourself, you know, making time to have this space in your life. So yeah, there's a whole program around it, but ultimately it's really sort of grounded in you just, and every week there's different prompts and different things you could be thinking about, but it's pretty free form. But at its core, it's just literally forcing you to write without critique, without edit, without fear, without anything, but just getting used to the idea of ideas flowing out of you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That sounds like an all too rare thing to experience. I love it. Graham, any books to read?
You know, I read a lot of books these days, but they're mostly kids' books that are, you know, heavy illustration and light on content. But
there's nothing wrong with that.
No, I love it, actually. I've actually found children's literature to be really inspiring. Like, it's beautiful. A lot of it's beautiful. The writing is so interesting because it's so to the point. But the only sort of, I guess, a grown-up book that I've read lately and would recommend is a book called Essentialism by Greg McKeown. I think it's probably 10, 15 years old now, but it's really about trying to arm you with some tools to find your focus and you know, suss out what's most essential in your life and work. And I'll echo Spencer's point, you know, being a founder is having every job in the business. So really taking the time to like find some focus and essentialism in, you know, both how I operate at work and at home, I've found to be like really, really, really rewarding and would highly recommend it.
Amazing. It's a really rare thing to happen, actually, that I think this is our 155th maybe episode. And all three of those books are brand new to Call to Action. So,
oh, great.
Yeah. So if you're listening, you can find links to Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, The Artist's Way and Essentialism, which is amazing. And then lastly, we always dedicate every episode to someone and we bestow or hospital pass that honor, depending on your view, to our guest who has to give their reason why. So I don't know if you've agreed to do this collectively or you're going to have one each, but we're about to find out. Would you do the honors?
I think we're pretty aligned here, Spencer. You think we could do a unanimous dedication from both of us?
I have a staunchly singular dedication. So
You go first then.
Yeah, I'm going to dedicate this to my partner, Graham. I think when you're in the thick of it, running a business, you're so heads down. Every day you hop on calls and you're just sort of in the trenches, digging in, seeking opportunities, trying to do the best thing you can. And even being on this call together, allowing us to reflect a little bit and just think about what we are trying to accomplish and have accomplished, I just wanted to say, Graham, thank you for being such an incredible partner through the ups and the downs, my friend.
Oh, bro, you're going to make me tear up over here. Well, I feel entirely the same way. And maybe the only thing I'll add so that we can actually go home to our families after this podcast is I think jointly would also love to dedicate this to our respective partners outside of work, you know, but a couple of amazing women who have allowed us to start a business while also enduring a pandemic and having young children and, you know, all of the biggest life changes that you could make at the same time. And there's absolutely no way we could have done this without a couple of pretty steady rocks
could not have done it without them.
Yeah, amazing. Well, that was a really beautiful and profound dedication. Firstly from you, Spencer, and obviously echoed by you, Graham. So this episode is very proudly dedicated, well, to you both, but also to your respective families who have allowed you to do what you do. So wonderful. As a final call to action, we're going to include links to everything we've discussed, to your crazy pong-playing website. How else can our listeners get more gas?
We're a pretty good LinkedIn follow. We're really trying to fuck with the system of LinkedIn a little bit in a fun way. So I nice. Would say... Give us a follow.
Yeah, Gus on LinkedIn.
Yeah, and then maybe I'll tease a coming soon. When we launched our website, we thought it would be really fun in the footer to not just have links to Twitter and LinkedIn, but to have a link to OnlyFans. And we've decided that in the coming year, we will launch Gus's very first OnlyFans series. So stay tuned for marketing wisdom with plenty of
and the money's gonna feet. Roll in.
Yeah, yeah.
OnlyFans and profit. So
yeah, exactly. Nice.
Amazing. Both of you, thank you so much for joining us. I've enjoyed this even more than I knew I would.
Oh, likewise, Charles.
Charles, it's been an absolute pleasure, man. Thank you for doing what you do, my friend.
And finally, thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do share and review the pod. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online or email the mouthful that is calltoaction@gasp.agency.
Can't get no call to action. I can't get no call to action. But I try, and I try, and I try, and I try.